Welcome to the American Reformer Podcast, hosted by Josh Abatoy and Timon Klein. Our mission is to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day, rooted in the rich tradition of Protestant social and political thought.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, to the American Reformer Podcast. Only one of your usual co-hosts here, Timon Klein, editor-in-chief. But I'm joined by a special guest, Nick Duncan. And I'm going to let Nick introduce himself. But we've been wanting to get Nick on for a while. Finally made it happen to talk about something that our pages cover a lot, and also is, if you're on, at least on certain circles of Twitter, is discussed a lot, which is what it means to have classical Christian education, how to run or plant, these schools in what we're calling negative world with all the new challenges that brings along with it. So we want to get into some of that today. But Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, Timon, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
So tell us a little bit about your, I almost used the word journey, which I never do. Tell us about your story, I guess we'd say, and how you got into doing what you're doing now, exactly what it is that you do, and give everybody the background so they kind of orient themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in rural Appalachia in East Tennessee, a little bit in Western North Carolina, and went to public schools growing up. My mom was a public school teacher for over 30 years. She's retired now. And I always wanted to be a history teacher and a baseball coach. I loved school. I loved learning. I know being a history teacher and a baseball coach is kind of, I think, a cliche combination, but
usually they're only good at one of the two, right?
That's right. So when I was going through undergrad and I was getting a degree in history and hoping to teach in public high school somewhere. And by the time I got done with my student teaching, the Lord had done a lot of work in my life. I grew up in the church. I grew up in independent fundamental Baptist churches, and I'm really thankful for the way that I was raised, thankful that my parents cared about the Bible and cared about church and God's people and modeled that well for me. But I did go to public school. And so by the time I was done with my student teaching, I knew, because I couldn't be free to share not even just Christ, but even a full proof history of America and the founding and Western civilization. And it was all very truncated and was political. And so by the time I got done with my undergrad, I had decided I didn't want to teach. And that kind of left me wondering what I would do, because that was all I had ever wanted to do. And I was working at a glass shop, installing commercial and residential glass doors and windows and such, and also working at a Christian bookstore. And one of my very best friends that I had made while I was working at that Christian bookstore said, "Hey, my sister teaches at this Christian school in town, and you should check it out. I think you'd be interested in it." And I played sports, and so I'd played against Christian schools growing up in East Tennessee, especially those in the Knoxville area. But that was basically the extent of my experience with private schools. And so I came and did a tour of the school, and the headmaster at the time handed me a letter that was written by a lady named Dorothy Sayers, and it was called The Lost Tools of Learning. And he said, "Go home and read this and come back next week and let's talk about it." And so I was engaged to my wife at the time. She also was looking for a job, and she was an elementary education major in her undergrad studies. And so we both read it, and we were just awestruck. Now, we were kind of left in wonder that education could pursue such things as Sayers had outlined. And so I basically said, "If that is what this school is pursuing, I want to learn about that, and I want to join in that." And so my wife and I both, we both started working at Highland Room Academy at the same time. And that was about 13 years ago. So this is my Well, this is my 12th school year in classical Christian education. I taught for a few years, taught for 3 years, and then I've been the headmaster for over 8 years. This is my 9th school year being the head of school here. So that's kind of how I came into the world. After I became the head of school, I wanted to learn even more. So I pursued a master's in classical Christian studies from New St. Andrews College. They have a really wonderful correspondence program that I couldn't recommend more highly, where you're doing a lot of things, of course, online, and a lot of readings. And then you do recitations together with your discussions and recitations with your professors every week. And then you go do residency in the summer there, and really enjoyed that experience and was able to get a taste of what we're trying to give to our students here. And so that's one of the biggest challenges of our movement, is we're trying to give something away that we did not receive ourselves. And so we are all in the process of actually educating ourselves. Whereas before, growing up in public school, the vast majority of us just received some sort of job training or trying to prepare you to get into whatever college so that you can go on to get a job. And so trying to understand what true education is, kind of reform our minds about that, and then to try to pass on something better to the next generation, our own children, than we received ourselves. So that's kind of in a nutshell how I got to where I am.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. We were sort of talking before we started recording. I also went to, my parents were public school teachers, still are. My dad was also a pastor for a long time, but before and now after, they were in the ministry for a long time. They've taught, and we can get into the difference between teaching in public schools in the late 80s and early 90s and teaching them now. They would yes. have testimony on that. But when I went to public school, and we were probably in same era of being in public school, I went to a very, very big county public high school with good sports and good facilities, very low quality education, and it was pretty boring to and unexciting, especially I think to young men, when you're being taught to the lowest common denominator, and all that sort of No Child Left Behind policy was in place, but it didn't have all the garbage that we have to deal with now in public schools. So that's right. One difference, but still it was, basically geared towards everything you listed. And then I went to a Christian college for a while, and it was the first time I had met kids that went to, sort of small public Christian schools where their graduating class would be like 10 people. And I was just, it was just a whole world. I had never, heard of I met one, I remember being in the dorm, and there was a set of two guys that were twins, and they were the top two in their class of seven, so it's like, it's just right. kind of like when my graduating class was over 300, I had no ability to understand this or what else it was that was out there in terms of the content, the curriculum. But over time, I've realized how much I missed by becoming yes. familiar with other schools, which is sad. I mean, you have a lot of regret through that. And then, like you said, you're just kind of playing catch up. I want to get into I mentioned negative world earlier, and I want to get into the unique challenges that come with that for classical Christian schools. But maybe we can begin with, I do see a new and sort of vigorous interest in educational alternatives out of right. parents that I talk to at church or wherever, because I think it's taken things to get so bad in public schools for them to recognize that there might be other options they need to consider. Yes. Are you seeing the same thing, that there's this sort of groundswell of interest? We might say it's a little late, but welcome to the party. Right. But do you see a growing demand and interest in getting out of public schools, going to Christian schools, ones that are aligned with, the same interests you'd have in your family, and people looking for those opportunities?
Yeah, that's a great question. We do see that. We are seeing that. We've seen it since, about summer of 2020, which makes a lot of sense probably to a lot of people. I think what we're experiencing now in the more, we're our town is, it's not huge. And so it's not like we live in a big city, and our town is the biggest city in a much more rural area. And so we serve, you know, a pretty conservative rural, you know, constituency. But I think what is now making its way to us, is what my brothers and sisters in classical Christian schools in the cities, have experienced for about the last 30 years. You know, something that's interesting when we talk about, you know, the negative world or the three worlds, and I'm thankful for that framework. I think it's been really helpful. I think that it's something important to notice is that different parts of the country have probably experienced the negative world at different times. And so I have, I know friends that were living in cities where they were in the negative world in the late 70s, early 80s. And so, and I think that's just now trickling out to, you know, places like rural America. And so, but that makes sense when you have things that are centrally planned, you know, by entities like the Department of Education. It's inevitable that it will get there. And so we hear a lot, even from, you know, good Christian folk that work in public schools that want to send their kids to our school because they can't fathom their kids being in their own classroom. And they think it's important that they're there to, you know, of course, there are tons of kids in public school that need to hear the gospel. And so they want to be there and be, you know, like a salt and light for those kids, but they're unprepared to give their children over to that, and for their children to be missionaries who, of course, are young and not discipled. And so that's kind of been a shift where when I started doing this 12 years ago in this area, it very much was a lot of people not hostile, but probably not understanding, why do you have that school? Because our public schools are safe. And Sister Sally, who sits three pews in front of me, is my kid's third grade teacher. And so I don't understand why you would need a Christian school, you know, because our public schools basically are Christian schools. And, but now that a lot of the craziness that you mentioned that even we didn't experience, you know, 20 years ago in public school has filtered down, you know, even in our public schools, there are LGBTQ clubs and just all kinds of craziness, and we're still probably some of the best public schools as far as they go. And so that's the biggest shift I think we've seen, is those sorts of things filtering down, continue to filter down. And of course, anywhere where you can find adolescents and children with cell phones and TikTok, you're going to get more and more and more of it. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that we've seen as well, is just that it's just become more and more pervasive for children to have access to all kinds of craziness, even on their own phones. And so, you know, Christian parents want to get their kids out of that environment. So we're seeing an uptick. There are other schools and homeschool umbrellas in our town that are seeing an uptick. And we're thankful for that as well, because we think it's good for Christian parents to have choices and options and to be able to pursue education's best for their children. So,
yeah, you sort of know that it's a good idea to look for alternatives when basically the, you know, the upper echelons of society, certainly in Silicon Valley, the people responsible for a lot of the, we could say the things that are delivering, and inserting a lot of problematic stuff into the education environment through the technology, they themselves opting out of its use, especially with their children. Right. And sending their, you know, Elon Musk has this like strange kind of school he sends his kids to and others go to, you know, they're sort of elite schools. So when they're opting out, it's probably a good time to start looking for your own exit tour. I always think, you know, when the Google engineers are on TED Talk saying that their kids have never used a screen in their life and stuff, it's like a good idea.
They know it's dehumanizing. And I think that's why, you know, the classical education model in particular is attractive to a lot of parents that see that, like, this, you know, modern progressive education and all the technology and everything is dehumanizing our children. And, you know, we're fundamentally asking the question, what does it mean to be human? And we're, you know, most classical Christian schools are no tech or a very low tech footprint. And I think that's compelling for people as well.
Yes. Yeah, so that's one, challenge, the technology. Another one, this is not all public high schools, but the ones that you see that are highlighted in the news and everything, you're having these massive school board battles over whether there's going to be, trans sex education. Yeah. And then you just have a lot of disorder and violence in a very literal way. Again, I said my parents are still public school teachers. I mean, that's what they see, which is obvious, for obvious reasons, unsafe, but disruptive of any kind of education environment. So those are all challenges, in the negative world that are here now for various reasons. What are the, kind of staying on that subject, those are the things that may be driving people away from public schools. But there's, it's not like the negative world by definition is overly conducive to starting or maintaining classical Christian schools, these sort of alternatives. So what are the challenges, at least in your experience, over a decade at this particular school in a, rural area, but near, a big town and not far away from other big towns. So it's not this total little house on the prairie isolation. Sure. What are the other challenges that performing this kind of exit and alternative move, face in the negative world, from your perspective?
Yeah, really good question. I actually think one of the biggest challenges for us, and this may be true of other, I'm sure it is true of other classical Christian schools that are in more rural contexts, is because there's so much Christian community here, and this kind of harkens back to what I was saying earlier. It's often the case that because those of us that are leading in our schools are trying to stay abreast of everything that's happening and the craziness, we see a need to, we believe you have to have good documents and you have to have good people in any institution at the very least. And so one of the things we've tried to do is to take our founding documents and to go the other direction with them, or to take policies and to kind of go the other direction with them, and to try to bring people along with that because they don't live in the negative world each and every day, they have a hard time understanding that. So for instance, something like we have a uniform here, but a uniform implies one form. And we actually have this uniform that currently that is like a few different forms that all complement each other. And so we have decided that we're going to go to one true form for the boys and one true form for the girls. And we said, if we're going to do that right now, the boys have to wear khaki pants in our uniform. The girls can wear khaki pants or they can wear a skirt. And we said, well, if we're going to go to one true form, let's have the young ladies wear skirts, which is that's a pretty standard thing for a private school. But because we're making a shift in a direction that is, more conservative, it's a lot of teaching families that are scared of being, legalistic or whatnot. It's a lot of bringing them along and saying, if we're only going to have one form, why wouldn't we want to teach, especially in our context? And people recognize this when you phrase it this way. Why wouldn't we want to teach our young ladies that, hey, there is a way you can dress that is distinctly feminine? It doesn't mean that a lady can't ever, wear a pantsuit or have pants on or anything, and they'll see their female teachers, wearing pants. But how can we kind of go in the other direction, with our guidelines about our hair and our guidelines about what we're wearing and our policies about having girls or having young men hold the door open for young ladies and then walking through and saying thank you. And it's like, of course, a lady can open a door for herself, but we want to teach these students in a world that's gone mad. We want to push the other direction and teach them that you're actually very distinctly made boys and girls. We want to aim your boyhood at your manhood. We want to aim your girlhood at your womanhood. And so partnering with parents in that and kind of bringing them along. It's not a super, people aren't incredibly resistant to that, but I do think people who grew up in, really conservative rural America are oftentimes afraid of being legalistic or not being cool. Part of living in the negative world. You know, Rand has written about this a lot, and you guys have talked about it. This is not a problem for me because I grew up in fundamentalist churches, and so we were never cool. A lot of people, even in evangelicalism, they want to be cool and they want to be liked, and they're afraid that they won't. They're afraid that they won't be winsome or they won't be persuasive if they're not nice enough or if they look crazy or. And we're not out to try to just look nuts and look crazy, but we also are saying, let's live in a way that's distinctly Christian and let's not care if people do think we're crazy. Just because the girls wear skirts. So that's just a really popular low hanging fruit. There are other things, but I think that, you know, living in a place that's not a super negative world yet and trying to protect against that, you know, prophets always sound crazy when they're sounding the alarm. They're never welcome in their own city. And so I think that's one of the challenges we face living in, doing this in rural America, which is different than a different experience of my friends that, you know, live in the cities. You know, I think it's easier for, it's kind of funny, you know, we've had the great migration over the last few years and we have a lot of families from the West Coast and, kind of the Northeast that have fled to places like that have fled to the Southeast. And so we have a lot of families from California and things like that. And they actually get it more quickly because they see what happens when, when it's either kind of Christ or chaos. And so they fled chaos and they understand like, yes, let's do things that are distinctly, Christian. And so, I think that's been one of our challenges and those prophets coming from far, far places have been helpful for our families that have grown up in this area.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, that's a good perspective on that. Cause I think a lot of, Texas is a big one that Californians are going to and this sort of thing. Sure. There's, I think rightly so, a fear that, they're just going to turn it into, you know, what they're fleeing, almost like an immigration argument. You know, if you're coming from Guatemala and there's enough of you at scale, it'll start looking like Guatemala instead of Texas.
Sure. Right.
It's that kind of argument. But it's the interesting perspective there is that the people, assuming they're coming for the right reasons, they're like, you know, the immigrant that's come from communist Cuba, and they're like, I came here for the opposite of that, you know.
Right.
So there's that as well. And I think, you know, one thing is to we may be crazy. The things Christians do now, trying to live in this particular way, that does have an element of insularity to it, but it's and also defiance and just trying to get some things back on track. It's actually the most normal thing in the world. The crazy thing is the anomalies are of the past, you know, few decades.
Right.
But kids wearing uniforms to school used to be the most normal thing in the world, and it's almost as to kind of object to it is almost like objecting to it in the military. It's like, well, part of the purpose of this is a place of formation, and we don't actually want to highlight your individuality to the point that it becomes controlling and we are in service to it. We're here to form you. You are here to be formed. And so the clothing and aesthetics do have a role in that, I think, information and the uniforms I think are conducive to it. So I'm a big fan for sure. And it also, it's kind of also like getting dressed to go to work in the morning. I mean, there's kind of a professional uniform, and it's teaching children, you know, getting them in that mode also to take themselves seriously. So there's lots of sort of intangibles, things you can't quite quantify that are in play that do have an effect. And it's not always easy to convince people of that. Something you mentioned earlier, though, it made me remember, you know, I don't know if you remember this, years and years ago, Vodi Bakum, and when he was in the SBC, maybe still is, but he was is more before he went to Zambia, you know, got in a lot of hot water for pushing private schooling then and getting an exit from public schools for an argument that you kind of, for the reason that you kind of alluded to, which was, this is a retreatist, non-missional attitude. He had lots of responses, one of which is, you know, taking care of your family. If you don't, you're worse than an unbeliever. Your kids are not missionaries. They need to be formed first before they could do anything of the kind.
That's right.
But at the time, you know, this is early 2000s, the public schools just didn't look that bad. But now that it's all, I mean, he's been vindicated, I think, in his
Yes,
argument.
yes.
So, I mean, do you, I think you mentioned this, I mean, do you still encounter church, wherever else, you know, this kind of resistance to it, that maybe it's inconsistent with being a Christian on a certain sort of martyrdom complex to do this, and therefore it's wrong, you know, which can steer a lot of people away from it. Is that still something, or is that totally dying from your perspective?
Yep, really good question. We saw a lot more of that, of course, 10 years ago than we see now. We have, we're not a massive school. We have 240 kids, K through 12. I mean, that's a pretty big school for, a rural area. But we have several families in our school that work in government schools in some capacity. And who, I interviewed a family just today, just this morning, who one of the parents works in the government school system, and they feel called to that. And but they say, we're not going to, we want to put our kids in a place like Highland Rim. We don't want to give our kids over to that system because they're not ready for that. So that's one of the criticisms that we face. There's different ways to enroll into a Christian school, and we are a covenantal enrollment or a discipleship-based enrollment. You'll hear those terms, and that means we require at least one parent to affirm our statement of faith and attend a Bible-believing church that would affirm the statement of faith. And that's different than, say, an evangelical school that would say, "Here's what we're going to teach, and you don't have to affirm this, but you just have to sign off that we're going to teach this to your kids." And both are fine and have their place. You just have to pick one and be consistent. And so we're a covenantal discipleship based school. And so, we're partnering with Christian families that want to put their kids into an environment where, not each and every kid is a believer, has confessed faith yet, but the parents are. And so we're all churning towards kind of the same vision or goal of what we want our boys and girls to grow up and be like as young men and women. And a lot of our parents that are working in environments where there's a distinctly different enculturation, a distinctly different paideia is a word we use a lot. They don't want their kids in that scenario. And that's stuff that we were hearing testimony of from other places around the country for many years. And now people have started coming in for family interviews and saying that in a way that they weren't saying that 10 years ago here. So I think that's the biggest change. And so people are saying, yeah, Christians should have a presence in those spaces, but they shouldn't give their children over to those spaces. So I think that's the biggest change we've seen. So I do believe it's dying. I don't believe it's totally gone. There's always going to be holdouts because I think because of that factor I mentioned earlier. I mean, we are This isn't just an evangelical problem. This is a if you've read Lewis on the inner ring, this is an inner ring problem. And so people want to be, they want to be cool, they want to be in the inner circles, they want to be liked, and they want to be in a community. And oftentimes they're willing to, give up or sell out on principles in order to remain part of a community, even one that's not good for them or is filled with a lot of trouble or wickedness. And so I think there'll always be people that say, well, this is going along with the spirit of the age, for lack of a better way to say it, that are going to do that in order to maintain what they think is cultural capital. So
The model you were describing, that Highland Rim practices, you know, I think is necessary and optimal, especially for not even just for Negative World, but for the institution itself, because we were also talking about this before we recorded. You know, I've known and do know several people that either teach in or are on boards of ostensibly classical Christian schools, and the ones that have chosen the sort of I think you call the, you know, evangelical model. We're going to teach this. As long as you're cool with us teaching this to your kids, they can come here. They don't have to be Christians themselves, and the family doesn't have to be Christian either. They don't have to be at a church, so on and so forth. And those seem to, the half-life on those institutions in terms of their internal integrity seems to be much shorter than the ones that are on what you're calling a covenantal basis.
Right.
I've seen it multiple times, and it just, it begins to change actually what is taught in the end, because it's not too long before you have dissenters, and there's sort of no legal, we might say, basis for enforcing, you know, the curriculum you've chosen, or to say, you know, we're not taking exceptions to this X, Y, Z. And before too long, you have out of necessity for the need to grow, to get resources, to get money, and have more and more people involved, it just changes the whole dynamic. And it's no longer, in very short order, you know, basically a few rounds, we could say an entire class going K through 12, a few rounds of that, and it's a totally different school. And then you lose the people that started it, and it's over. And it's not really a real alternative to what people are, you know, we're talking about or fleeing. So that covenantal model, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's just, to me, self-evidently better than a more neutral world approach, which is like we teach stuff and, you know, everyone thinks Christianity is either fine or maybe even good for their kids. They could be like, you know, Muslims, but they think, yeah, this is good for my kid. And we're not going to make a stink about it because it's fair that this institution is distinct and is Christian. In negative world where you have more hostility to that and more motivation for disruption out of people that no longer think Christianity is good. I especially don't see it as a viable model. But what are your thoughts on that? I mean, I know you came to Highland Rim and it was already started, but was there a process there in solidifying or establishing that requirement for entry to sort of protect, you know, the institution against change in that regard? Or was it something that was just kind of in the DNA from the beginning?
Good question. I do prefer it. I think it's the best model. And like you said, this is the model that I came into. Being an accredited school in the Association of Classical Christian Schools, you get to, administrators of accredited schools do site visits for other schools that are seeking accreditation or reaccreditation. So we see lots of different stuff because ACCS doesn't have a particular enrollment model that they require. You just have to be consistent with your own principles. And so we've seen all kinds of stuff. And I do think just from what I've seen out there that, the covenantal model is the best. I think it's the best at protecting your culture. I think it's, like you said, it's the best at keeping your school from vision drift. And, you know, school boards and administration, like you said, when you get to a place where, you know, you have so many kids and students and programs and you're willing to oftentimes give up on your principles in order to feed the beast kind of financially, monetarily. And so I do think it's the best. I've seen some models where, our school is broadly Protestant evangelical. So we have a statement of faith that's kind of merely Christian. So we are interdenominational and we value the different traditions and denominations that people come from. And that's true of our families and our faculty and staff. And so you have some schools that are more evangelistic in the way they enroll, but they have a really tight, very particular tradition or confession that their staff and faculty have to affirm. And so I know of a school that you have to affirm the Westminster Confession of Faith and larger and shorter catechisms, but they enroll in a way that's more broad. So where they would enroll, like you had mentioned, like a Muslim family. And they oftentimes have odd enrollment percentages where they'll say, well, we won't let a class be more than 25% unbelieving families or something like that. But I just think that you get into, like you said, the dicey waters of, okay, well, this class is at 25%. And are we going to break our own policy because we need, you know, three more tuitions in order to balance the budget this year or to do whatever, fund whatever program we have or need. And so I think it's an easy way to drift. It's not the only way, but I do think it is a really easy way.
Well, speaking of the culture, you know, of a school, I want to get into a little bit of the curriculum debates that are going on right now inside of broadly Christian classical schools. You know, it's a lot of those, the people pushing the debate or driving it are Catholic, you know, evangelicals involved as well. But it's all kind of this question over how do we decide what does it mean to actually be both classical and Christian? What does that mean for our curriculum? And, you know, there's always got to be choices made. So what's on what basis do you know, include certain things and exclude others? And there's a faction, at least as I perceive it, of this debate that a lot of what they push for is kind of on a rationale, predicated on a rationale or basis that is not very different from the one the world would use in how you determine, you know, public school curriculum, which seems problematic to me. But how do you in since in Highland Rim generally, how do you think about your curriculum? How do you make those choices? And, you know, kind of for what reason? How is it thought through?
Really good question. The great Western canon debates of 2023 were those were really, really interesting. And so I tried to keep up with all of that and actually downloaded a lot of those articles so that I could just continue to remind myself about you know, what's important in choosing your curriculum. So, you know, it's classical education. So the goal is for this to be a tried and true way of educating people that have been educated for a really long time, and we know it works. And so we know that, you know, the goal is to teach young the our goal is for young men and women to grow up, or boys and girls to grow up into young men and women that love the Lord and love people and know how to think well, but not to be, I always think people think that it's often like becoming a free thinker. And it's not becoming a free thinker in the way that the world would think about that. It's becoming someone who knows how to think like a Christian. Like, how does a young Christian man think? How should a young Christian lady think? And so, we believe that classical Christian education has shown us the way to best do that. And so the content matters, but it only matters so long as it puts really good ideas, debates, questions. What does it mean to be human in front of the students? And we don't need to go searching for new stuff because we have really good old stuff that we know works at doing that. And so we can get into scruples, I think, when we get to the fringes, but there's only so many things that students can read in their time with us in their 13 years. And so we're going to start with the best and we're going to work our way down. And so we're, you know, there's a Mount Rushmore of the epics that are Homer and Dante and Milton and Virgil. And you start there. And then kind of to what you had said, I think, Timon, before we started recording, then you go, who in the next age was reading those guys and built upon the work that they did? It's called a great conversation for a reason. And so I've heard you talk on other episodes about reading the reformers and saying, well, these guys were reading the church fathers. And I've heard you say Calvin was reading, you know, the ancient pagans. And so, you know, these are the people that we want to read because the best parts of Western civilization, and we talked about this a little bit earlier as well, the best parts of what it means to be an American, are founded on this great conversation and these great ideas. So, you know, who is engaging in these ideas? And it doesn't matter, you know, people are frankly afraid to have a curriculum that is only full of dead white guys. And we want to have a curriculum that is full of people who have engaged with the greatest ideas and who continue to. And so the hope is that that'll grow over time. And so if they're dead white guys, then so be it. But that's not why we're reading them. We're reading them because they've engaged with the great conversation, and we want our students to continue that conversation and to keep it going. So, you know, we only have so many slots to pick. We start with in the Western canon what we think is the best, and we kind of just go from there, and who's engaged in that conversation.
Yeah, so when we were talking about this before, the you know, my as we already established, we went to public schools, so no, I mean, maybe there was some selections, you know, in a textbook from you know, I think we had a Shakespeare unit where you're reading pieces of things, and for what purpose, I'm not sure. And but anyway, there's no coherence to it, but you're kind of getting a smattering of things and none of it sticks. And so all of my like classical exposure really has come through reading early moderns. And I, for instance, the first time I read the Aeneid was because I was reading this, I was doing in my graduate work some work on particular debates in the early 18th century over some ecclesiastical polity issues. And there were all these allusions and citations to various classical sources, and one was, to Virgil. And it was just sort of cited, and I was like, well, I've got to go read this now to figure out what why it's there, and many such cases. So that's I kind of have this bizarre winding through classical literature for that reason. When I, Calvin's first works or commentaries on Seneca and these things,
Right.
which is helpful, but not exactly a directed study through things. But that's how I've picked it up. So it's much better if at an earlier stage, when you have time, you can get someone. To guide you through it and to give you it's comforting and good. It allows you to be able to tackle things seriously if you have some kind of curation. It's not just an ocean you're being thrown into.
Right.
So I think that's very good and helpful, and it's helpful for I was talking with Daniel Dreisbach, the scholar of the American founding, not too long ago, and we were talking about how if you haven't Another example of this is if you're not familiar with the King James Bible, you miss a lot of things in 18th century literature because not everything's given a citation. But if you are familiar with the King James and you've read it yourself and even devotionally, you pick up on allusions and even just the sort of cadence and style of prose and all these things. You really catch something historically, and so I think. Getting into whatever is called great books, whatever, it also helps you understand your own culture better. All these debates with what the meaning of the founding is and our documents and all this stuff is very difficult if you have uneducated people in this way. That's why a lot of
Right.
it comes across bizarre at this point from that perspective. So it's useful in not only making educated virtuous, Christian students, but also good Americans, I would say, because it is part of our tradition, that great conversation you're talking about.
That's right. I mean, if you go read, our students read the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, and if you don't read works like that, then you won't understand the American project at all. And that's what you have now is you have generations of a populace that are completely cut off from their own history, so they can't even fathom it. It's pretty wild, but you have the vast majority of Americans that are cut off from what it means to actually be American when you drill down to the root of it. And so which I think is something that Screwtape told Wormwood that he should do, was cut people off from their history. And so that's kind of what we're dealing with. And that's what we're trying to recover here. We're not just trying to recover people that have, read the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, and Homer and Dante, just so they can go out and say that they read them or get into a, liberal arts college or whatever. True education is trying to teach to the whole person. And so, what is it? We've talked about manhood, womanhood. What does it mean to be a man or a woman? What does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be father or mother or a son or a daughter? What does it mean to be a citizen in a democracy, who lives in a republic? We're trying to teach to the whole person, which is to go back to what we were talking about earlier, distinctly different than what we were given in our public schools, which was job training or getting us ready for to get into a particular college. And so job training's good. I mean, we all pursue it when we have a job, but that should not be the, that's not true education.
Or even you'd be lucky to get job training in public schools now.
Sure.
And primarily it's hitting the markers so that the teacher doesn't get fired, right? So they can check the boxes and they keep their job.
That's
That's kind of
yeah.
the whole
When you were
thing,
saying earlier that
teaching to these.
sorry, Tom, when you were saying earlier, I read excerpts of things, and I was like, yeah, I remember reading excerpts of Beowulf or excerpts of Hamlet, and you were like, I'm not really sure why, and I was like, because the state said so that the teacher had to, I think is the only answer that they can.
The teacher has to, or they'll get. Which is another thing that not as often talked on this, but this isn't as often talked about. But you sort of alluded to it at the beginning. The it, it's it is about the students and educating them. But then also people who want to actually be teachers, they're remarkably unfulfilled if you talk to public school teachers because they can't actually teach. They're constricted by, as you said, a sort of centralized standard that somebody essentially in a laboratory has come up with for some reason. They're probably products of the same thing, so it's perpetuated. And teachers are miserable in public schools. I mean, my younger brother was going through college and doing a student. He got to the point where he was doing his student teaching, and just totally, ditched it. And I think went into a business degree or something because it was so awful. That he just knew it was going to be terrible, even though the idea and the sort of passion for being a teacher was there. It's not available. It's not really an option for those people. Because you have to get a job. So, this, the classical and Christian education model, especially for Christians who know they're going to be restricted, in terms of they've got to leave the biggest piece of them at the door when they come into a public school, which is their faith. It's demoralizing for them as well. So no one in a public school, it's just an entire, it's like a cloud of demoralization. It's just hanging over it. And then you're telling kids, we're telling everybody they're learning something, learning to read, although all the test scores say they can't read or do
That's
math or
right.
anything.
That's
So it's just awful. It's a bad cocktail that's and it is at scale. Our public school system is massive, and so you're really doing this to an entire population. And you're not, I mean, if you read Benjamin Rush on education in a republic, we're doing like it's like we went through and said, let's do the opposite of everything he
Yes.
says for our
Well,
country.
it's like everything
So
else. If you were writing
it's just awful.
a playbook on how to destroy a society, like the current public school system is the one that you would concoct to do that. I mean, it is, it's like you said, it aims at these standardized testing scores that no one can meet, and yet everyone is just passed on anyways. And I talk to teachers all the time that teach in public high schools, and the students don't know how to read. So how do we expect them to learn anything else? And we say all the time here that the first 3 or 4 years at our school is learning how to read, so that you can read how to, so that you can read to learn. And so if you don't know how to read, and so the idea of something we do that's novel that people forget ever used to happen is we might say this first grader needs to do first grade again because they need more skills in reading before they go on. And that's something that our parents understand and appreciate. But for the vast majority of people, that's, oh my goodness, their self-esteem's never going to recover. And I'm like, well, their self-esteem, what if they can't read? What will their self-worth be like if they can't even read? This is how, especially for Christians, this is how God has revealed himself to his people, just through his written word. And so, teaching students to read is fundamentally the most important thing that we do here. And we have a whole, generations of people that are illiterate.
Indeed. Well, we do have Terry is on with us now, and Terry teaches great books at Highland
Yes, he
Run,
does.
among other things. So, Terry, I'm not sure exactly what point you jumped in and what you heard, but we were on the topic of curriculum and what we teach. So what are your thoughts on the particular curation of the great tradition? What do you use in your classes at the level you're teaching, and how exactly do you approach those with your students?
Sure. Well, with I have seniors, I have 12th graders. So these kids are the, in theory, if our mission objectives have been accomplished up to this point, they're starting to look really close to what we want them to look when they get their diplomas. So we spend a lot of time, just with class, we spend a lot of time on graded discussion work, which we have a rubric which has been painstakingly perfected over a long time. For how to measure that. But what we have generally coached them on is this should look like a conversation amongst learned people who are interested in the same topics. And sometimes you have to fake it because you may not personally like the book we're reading, or you might not find politics to be an interesting topic, but you should be able to have the skills by the time you're at this age to maintain a conversation with others about the content. And we find that that's pretty generally the case. So with our class, it's a very large class. So with I'm not sure how other folks would do like high school credits, but ours get 2.5 credits out of this one class. So it's like 10 hours a week. And we do a lot of reading of primary sources when possible. And it's a mixture in senior year, it's a mixture of government and civics related, history related, and literature stuff. So our first semesters mostly are government and civics. So we start with Paradise Lost. But while we're covering epic poems, while we're covering Paradise Lost. Now, this is also, by the way, keep in mind, this is a group of kids who have, if they come up through seventh grade, they've already read multiple Homers. They've read Virgil. They've read Dante. They've read Beowulf. They've read, the greater and lesser epic poems of our Western canon. So by the time they arrive at Milton, they're able to kind of almost cross-reference things themselves. They recognize, hey, for instance, Milton is appealing to the Holy Spirit as his muse rather than a pagan muse like Homer did. Mm-hmm. But there's still a nod to Homer in the way that he does that. So they identify these things. These are the kinds of things that we discuss when we have our greater discussions. So while we're doing that, while we're reading that, we're also going to be discussing, for instance, the English Civil War and Milton's, we don't read this because we don't have time, but we discuss Areopagitica and Milton's kind of anti-crown work. And we will also read Hobbes, who was kind of his opposite number in a couple of ways. And we read Leviathan. We read sections of Leviathan because Leviathan is very large. But we want to try to derive the most important parts of his philosophy from his work. And it's interesting to hear the kids discuss the merits of monarchy versus republicanism. And so we work our way forward from that time in history. Chronologically is not always the ideal way to do it, but it often is because the next guy usually builds upon the understandings of the former. And so we work our way from there all the way up through the American founding. And so we're getting late in the year now. We're reading Ernest Hemingway at the moment. We're reading The Sun Also Rises, which was written in 1926, if I remember right. And so while we're reading this and discussing Hemingway's literary and prose style, we're also talking about the progressive era of American politics. So, roughly 1865 through 1930 or so. What do the political parties look like? What was going on? What are the social initiatives? What are the constitutional amendments that are in question? So they're getting a look into the world through Hemingway's writing. They kind of learn about the way people live. They learn about Hemingway's storytelling ability. We're kind of recovering from just reading All Quiet on the Western Front because they just had to do that. We covered World War I at that time. So that's kind of the way that we structure the classes is we work our way through historical eras, looking at the best of the literature, history, and usually theology books in the process. So the upper division classes, though, have their theology broken out into a separate class. So we don't cover that as much in great books. But that's kind of how we do it. And the older they get, the more their complete thinking is tested. So there's less fill in the blanks. There's less multiple choice. Most of my tests are just essays. And then their other grades primarily come from graded discussions. And then periodically I'll have them write an essay that's not a test. But that's basically the gist of it. We want them to be able to.
So there's an oral. Oh, sorry. You include, an oral portion of the grading as well, and at least in terms of the discussion.
Sure.
It's writing plus oral, which I think is great to include that also.
Yeah. Well, they've got to be able to interact with the ideas, and it's not always like you don't get a prompt and you get to think about it and sort of do an outline in your head. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a kid says something in class and you may disagree with it. Well, can you formulate an argument that's respectful, that's relevant, that's convincing and persuasive? Mm-hmm. And can you, deliver that in a kind of an ad hoc, like improvised setting? At the younger levels, we train them on this and we teach them, we'll give them questions to consider leading into the discussions and give them plenty of notice. But as a senior, I pretty much just go in sometimes and I'm like, all right, we're having a great discussion over the reading that was due. Mm-hmm. So they'll just get their chairs in a circle and we begin. And that's really all the prep work that they need. The teachers at the younger grades have done such a good job of training them on.
Yeah. See, this is cards on the table. The only reason I care about this is I don't know if you guys have been to sort of DC World cocktail hours, but they're incredibly boring and awful. And classical education is just about making those a better experience. It's a civil service, and so if people can actually talk about interesting things, the country would be so much better, at least from my perspective.
Yeah.
And it would make eating the rubber chicken dinner afterwards much more enjoyable. if it wasn't, if people weren't so dull. So this is a true civil service. But no, this is, you know, I think this, I mean, it's nothing like I never had any of that, you know, in high school. And it would have been so much sure. more exciting and engaging if you had, again, especially I think for young men who want to, have something aspirational to sink their teeth into, but also learn how to intellectually contend with one another, and develop those largely atrophied muscles, in our society now. So it's not even just what I'm hearing you say, Terry, you know, obviously the content has to be there. People have to grasp it to be able to, perform these functions, but it's also teaching them how to be an adult, I guess I would say an intellectual adult and, you know, engage with one yep. another and handle ideas. And, you know, in that sense, a very liberal aspiration of, you know, being able to expect that of one another and engage with ideas at a proper level rather than whatever passes for that kind of engagement today in public life.
Sure. Yeah. And those skills transfer over to other classes as well. We've been focused on grade books. As it happens, both Nick and I are both kind of have the grade books in our blood, but you know, their math classes do this. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's less ambiguity in the discipline of math, but they still have discussions. They still have conversations mm-hmm. about things. They do this in science classes, of course, because inquiry is an important part of scientific pursuit. So they need to be able to formulate a question that's worth finding an answer to, and then be able to pursue an answer with integrity. Mm-hmm. And all these skills really are, it's not limited to great books. Great books is a big part of the core of the classes that they take because of just the sheer volume of how much they have to do in there. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's a part of the education of the complete person.
Mm-hmm. So, gentlemen, we're coming up on the hour here, and I don't want to keep you longer than we agreed to, but, you know, I think we've covered a decent amount of ground, on this, both the challenges of doing this, but the necessity of it as well. And in the world we live in, although there's always been part of the reason we find ourselves in this world is because it was neglected for a while. What are, you know, give us the white pill on your way out as to why you're encouraged and think we're going to win, in this regard. And, you know, give some kind of encouragement to parents too, also to, you know, find communities like this that provide true learning and formation for their children. That's actually Christian and actually takes, as Nick said, the dead white guys seriously.
Yep. A few things. One, you know, the ACCS has done a study, the only one of its kind really at this point, called the Good Soil Report. And you can find that on their website. And it's a study that Cardis did. And it kind of it compared life outcomes, not just intellectual kind of traditional academic stuff, but life outcomes of students over the last 40 years that have gone through classical Christian schools, but also traditional Christian schools that are not classical, homeschooling, and public schools. And there's no question based on the way that the respondents of that survey answer that classical Christian schools are the best soil as far as the life outcomes that all of those all those different entities are aiming for. The students from classical Christian schools are better church members. They serve their community in more deep and fruitful ways. They get married and stay married. They have children. So Christians in general are having more children than their secular neighbors. Mm. And so if Christians are having more children and they're sending them to places like classical Christian schools to learn how to think like Christians, then they're going to be way ahead of their peers. And you know, we're gonna win just because of that. Well, I'm post-millennial anyway, so I think we're gonna win generally. But I think that's one of the ways. And you know, I know I have a lot of good optimistic all-millennial brothers, and so that you don't have to be post-mill. But nevertheless, I do think that the advancement of the gospel and good Christian thinking primarily happens in families. And we exist, and schools like ours exist, to partner with families and aid them in supporting what they're already teaching at home and what they're hearing in their churches. And it's a paideia. It's an enculturation. It's a way of life. And there are competing paideias in this country. And I think that the Christian paideia is much more compelling than the soulless, secular humanistic paideia. And so we need to have children. We need to raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And we need to let them go off and subdue and take dominion over the earth. And they'll be much better equipped to do that than their neighbors that don't have the skills that they have.
Mm. Yeah, it reminds me always of the initial kind of correspondence on in Massachusetts Bay on starting Harvard, right? And there, of course, we would describe most of those people there as post-mill, but there's no mention of eschatology in their original kind of plea for the corporation to be established, to get the money and get teachers, but their concern is if we don't do this, if we don't educate the next generation, we will die. There's everything we're trying to build yes. in this society will fall apart, and we have no hope. And so it's not even an eschatological hope they're talking about. They're talking about the present, you could say, way of life as you did, and just your sort of civilizational yeah. existence is dependent on this. So if you like your country and your people, you have to do this. It's just a non-negotiable. And you have to take it serious. And we can debate eschatology later.
Yeah, yes, we can. And that's a great example that you mentioned there, Massachusetts Bay. And then also, I know a lot of American Reformer people that run in the American Reformer circles are familiar with Benjamin Merkel's The mm-hmm. White Horse King. And mm-hmm. so King Alfred's mm-hmm. another good example of, we've seen this in history before. So I think the white pill is we've seen it before. We know how the Lord works through families and through churches and how he has in his providence, how he has built through the transformative power of the gospel, how he mm-hmm. has built great civilizations before. And so we need to, there are tried and true methods that are good soil. We know that Paul said that he planted and that Apollos watered and that the Lord gave the increase. So mm-hmm. it's all glory to the Lord for the increase. But we do believe that there's good soil that the Lord most often works in. There are ordinary ways in which he has most often worked through history. And, those are what we're trying to pursue.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, Nick, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure we could go on. And Terry, thanks for joining also and telling us about your work. And it's Highland Rim Academy, right?
Highland Rim Academy.
Okay.
That's right.
So everyone go check that out. If you, to see what they're doing, especially if you're nearby. But for inspiration and ideas as to how this can be done, especially if you don't have an option like that in your area. So go look at these models. And Nick, is there anything else they should be the audience should be looking at to follow your work, or is there any other resources you want to direct them to?
I would just say, for primers on classical Christian education, the liberal arts tradition by Clark and Jane is really good. Both of Douglas Wilson's works on recovering lost tools of learning, those are his earlier thoughts. And then The Case for Classical Christian Education are his later thoughts. Those are sources that I would start with if you're new, to what we're talking about or to what we're doing. And then I would just, nothing personally for me, but I'd just encourage people to continue to pursue, finding out all they can. The classical model, it's been around for a long time and it doesn't change, but our discovery of it has grown as we continue to dig things up. And so I just encourage people to do kind of like what we've talked about that we've all done, which is to re-educate mm-hmm. themselves. And so mm-hmm. don't just read about classical Christian education, but start reading the great books and the great works mm-hmm. and you'll become a more wise and virtuous person. So,
all right. Very good. It's a good word to end on. Thank you to the audience for listening. Of course, subscribe to the podcast and to the website, AmericanReformer.org. Until next time, God bless.
You can find American Reformer on the internet at www.AmericanReformer.org or on X.com, formerly Twitter, at AM Reformer. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. please consider supporting us today by making a tax-deductible donation through our secure online donation portal at AmericanReformer.org. That's AmericanReformer.org.